Israel's prime minister says as long as there's rocket fire, the crossings will not function normally. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Nebraska lawmakers are to begin debating a bill today that would change the state's safe haven law. There's a push to set an age limit of 30 days for children who may be legally abandoned under the law. The proposal is designed to stop a rash of drop-offs of older children, including teenagers. Astronauts will begin the first of a series of planned spacewalks today. They'll be trying to loosen up a massive joint that turns solar panels on the International Space Station. Problems with the joint have limited how much solar power the station can produce. Today's spacewalk is the first of four during Shuttle Endeavour's nearly two-week visit to the station. I'm Giles Snyder in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Chevy, developing the Chevy Volt, a car that will go up to 40 miles on a fully charged battery before using any gas.
Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at tnol.com.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Bah Humbug Productions, presenting their second annual production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol at Parkland College. Adaptation by Nick Schneider, with original music by Tim Schirmer. Performances are December 5th through 21st. Ticket information and reservations at 351-2528.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about democracy and human rights in Saudi Arabia, and also about relations between Saudi Arabia and the United States. And the guest we have with us this morning is Dr. Ali Al-Yami. He's the founder and the executive director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, a group that is based in the United States in Washington, D.C. It was founded to promote democratic changes in Saudi Arabia. They're also interested in promoting religious freedom and women's rights. Our guest, Dr. Al-Yami, was born in Saudi Arabia. He has been living now in the United States for the past 37 years. Before becoming involved with the organization that he started, he was a senior fellow at the Saudi Institute in Washington, D.C., director of an educational peace program for the American Friends Service Committee in San Francisco, and also representative for the Arab Organization for Human Rights in North America. That's a Cairo-based group. He's spoken at conferences throughout the United States and also in Egypt, Sudan, Israel, and London. He has given testimony before the U.S. Congress, has advised senior officials in the U.S. government. He's also been involved in organizing and participating in conferences around the Arab-Israeli conflict, trying to work to facilitate dialogue and reconciliation between Arabs, Jews, and Israelis. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and of course, questions and comments are welcome. We always encourage people to call in and share their thoughts. The only thing we do ask is people are brief as possible so that we can keep things moving along, getting as many callers as possible. But certainly, people who are listening are welcome to call 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go ahead anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. At any point here, your questions are welcome. Dr. Al-Yami, hello.
Yes, thank you, sir, very much for inviting me this morning.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I was very struck by something that you wrote, and it must have just been recently, and I think it would be a good place to start, where you make the argument that now that here in the United States we will have a new president and a new administration, it is a good opportunity to change the way that the United States thinks about and relates to the Arab world. And particularly, you have said it would be a good place to start, perhaps no better place to start than with Saudi Arabia. Maybe I would ask you first if you would talk a little bit about the United States and its policy toward the Arab world and how you think it would be good for that policy to change.
Well, the United States policy towards the Arab world has been supporting Arab governments. None of them is legitimate. None of them is elected freely. And a lot of the resentment that many of the Arabs, especially intellectuals and educated people and women, lots of that resentment is directed towards the U.S. because of the support for those regimes. Now, the Arab people are changing in many different ways. They are embracing modernity. They are embracing liberties. Many of them have become educated in Western universities. The flow of information, especially the satellites, TVs, internet, have shown them that their counterparts in the rest of the world are doing much better off when it comes to the individual liberties, woman rights, minority rights, religious freedom. And that policy, U.S. policy toward that region, and that is the support for these regimes, have actually not created stability, as many administrations have been telling the American people that we need stability in the Middle East. I mean, there is some stability somehow, but it's a false stability. It's stability by the sword. And because of that, the result of that kind of stability, what was created is religious extremism, which was culminated in the 9/11 attack on the United States by Al-Qaeda and its recruits. So with the coming of President-elect Obama, who is very, very popular among many people in the Middle East for varieties of reasons, but there is a hope among many Middle Eastern people that he will support democratic reforms, he will support women's rights, he will support religious freedom. This is especially, these sentiments are especially, you will find them among many educated people, non-sectarian religious scholars, young people. You know, majority of the Middle East, of the Arab populations, are under 25, 30 years of age. So they are disconnected from their past, and they are more in tune with modern lives, internet, computers, cell phones, and other things like that. So I'm not sure what the new administration is going to do. And the Arab regimes are aware that their people are hopeful that Mr. Obama will change things. And because of these hopes among the Arab people, the Arab-controlled media are already depicting Obama as anti-Arabs, anti-Palestinians. They are putting him in a very negative light in order for their people to give up hopes that he might do something better than the previous administrations.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, your particular interest is in Saudi Arabia and in reform in that country. Do you think that, however, perhaps that country, Saudi Arabia, functions as a good example or perhaps a leading example of all of the things that you would say you would like to see change, things that are problematic and perhaps lead to greater instability rather than stability? And certainly the number one thing would be a government which has not been democratically elected.
Yes, of course. You know, I have done everything else. I have worked in the Arab-Israeli issues, Latin American issues, South African issues. I have done everything imaginable when it comes to human rights activities and promotion of democratic values. I happen to believe that, you know, we are not recreating the planet again. Democratic values, democratic institutions, respect for human rights, women's rights, integration of society have worked very well in countries where these things have been implemented in Western Europe and Taiwan and Hong Kong and South Korea and South Africa, and you name it. So Saudi Arabia is at the heart of these issues. It is the birth of Islam, the home to its holy shrines. It has a lot of money and oil, and 1.5 billion Muslims Incidentally, the overwhelming majority of Muslims are not Arabs. The Arabs happen to dominate Islam culturally. But the majority of Muslims are not Arabs. There are more Muslims in India than most of the Arab world, actually. So the thing is, Saudi Arabia could set an example. For example, if you empower women in Saudi Arabia, which definitely needs to be empowered, women in Saudi Arabia are probably among the most disenfranchised people on this planet. But if you empower women in Saudi Arabia, that would resonate throughout all Muslim communities, because most Muslims look up to Saudi Arabia for examples. And if you have a government, and it has to, I mean, something has to happen in Saudi Arabia, because the present government is very unstable, both domestically and threatened from outside the country. Saudi Arabia can lead Arabs and Muslims in a more democratic, tolerant, progressive direction. Or it could stay the way it is with this extremist Wahhabi ideology, which does not recognize non-Muslims, totally opposed to women's rights, minority rights, and promoting religious incitement against non-Muslims. And a good example of that was what was happening in Iraq. According to American generals, more than 40% of the suicide bombers in Iraq were Saudi citizens. So Saudi Arabia is in a position to lead, and I happen to believe that external pressures like this phone radio talk show and the media could go a long way to put pressure on the existing Saudi regime and to change or transform its institutions, especially religious and educational institutions. Those are the institutions that indoctrinate people, both within the country and outside of the country, to reject democratic values, to reject non-Muslims, to reject empowerment of women. So Saudi Arabia is at the heart of these issues, and it must change for the sake of the Muslim people and the Arab people themselves, but for the relation with the international community.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for this hour. We're speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami. He is the director and founder of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. That organization is based in Washington, D.C. He was born and did some of his growing up there in Saudi Arabia, then came more than 20 years ago to the United States for his education and has stayed since. We're talking about human rights and democracy in Saudi Arabia, also about the relationship between the Saudi Arabia and the United States. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think for a long time now, both governments, the Saudi government and the government of the United States, have talked as if the two nations are great friends and that the relationship is very important. And I think also, though, that people understand that this is perhaps a marriage of convenience more than anything else, and that the interest of the United States is continued access to oil, and the interest of the Saudis is to have the backing and support of the United States. Do you think, in fact, it is the case that Saudi elements in Saudi Arabia, maybe not necessarily within the government, but elements in Saudi Arabia actually have done things that were counter to the interest of the United States, and that the United States chose to look away because of its interest in continuing to have access to oil?
Oh, without any question. I mean, this is admission by a lot of American officials, including Mr. Bush and his secretary, Dr. Rice. The United States, and I quote, have looked the other way while people's hopes and aspirations were crushed, and the result is, religious totalitarianism. This is nothing hidden. First of all, it is important for your listeners to understand that the United States policy towards Saudi Arabia especially is not determined by the interest of the United States and the American people. It is determined by interest group or groups, oil companies, bankers, institutions, learning institutions who receive money from the Saudis for research and, you know, the other reasons. So it is not exactly, the relationship is not predicated on the interest of the United States as a whole and the American people and the United States national security. Unfortunately, that's the case. Unless that changes, and it has to change for everybody's sake, we will see more of 9/11s and even more catastrophic events. You know, there are no two nations that are diametrically opposite and different than Saudi Arabia and the United States. Saudi Arabia is ruled by an absolute monarchy where there are no civil society, no respect for women's rights, no religious freedom, no independent judicial system, no transparency, no accountability, nothing. While the United States is governed by elected government, where we have checks and balances, we have independent judicial system, we have free press, we have Bill of Rights, we have constitutions. So there are no countries that are totally different. So the relationship is based on groups and individual interests, and based mostly in money-making values, as opposed to the values that make this country the envy of the rest of the world. So the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia, which is totally controlled by the royal family, the religious establishment, the Wahhabis and the religious police and all of these people, they are only as powerful as they are allowed by their controllers, and that's members of the royal family. They are the ones who are inciting their people against the United States. They are the ones who are inciting their people against the Christians and Jews and Hindus and Buddhists and non-Muslims. So, yes, there are a lot of people in Saudi Arabia. The government itself, because religious establishment is half of the government itself is doing more harm to the American democracy than probably any country in the world. So the relationship is based on the false and wrong pillars, and that has to change.
Well, just, and I have a caller here, I promise this person I will get to them. Just quickly, though, given, again, the importance of access to oil to the United States, what sort of leverage do you think that the U.S. government would have over the Saudi government if the U.S. was interested in trying to push for change? Do we indeed have any leverage?
We have a lot of leverage. You know, the Saudi government cannot survive without external superpower protection. They thought the Chinese and the Indians and the Russians and other people were going to take over from the United States. But that didn't work out. King Abdullah tried that when he took over the operation of the country in 1996. He said that Saudi Arabia and the United States interests are different, therefore we have to go our separate ways. So he tried very much at the beginning to really divorce his country from the United States. Well, he found out that the only country that could protect him and his family is the United States. In terms of oil and access to oil, the Saudis and anybody who has oil will have to sell it. Otherwise, they will starve their people, and their people will revolt against them and destroy them. There is no way that there will be denial of access to oil. That's one thing. The other thing, if it comes to that, then the United States, in collaboration with the rest of the world, including China and India and Europe and everybody else, will have to talk to these people and said, you have oil, it's under your ground, it's fine, it's yours, but without the flow of oil to the international markets, the world economy is going to collapse. And the Saudis have learned a good lesson, actually, in the last 6 months, that when the meltdown of the economic crisis that we are suffering from and the whole world is suffering from, they know that their oil is worthless because it was $140 prior to the economic meltdown. Now it is $60 and going down. So they know that their oil is useless until the economy of the world is strong and thriving.
We have a caller in Bloomington, Indiana. Let's talk with them, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned the lack of religious freedom in Saudi Arabia. Recently, a United Nations conference was called by Saudi Arabia. This is a United Nations conference, and they called it on religious tolerance. Conference called by Saudi Arabia on religious tolerance in the United Nations. As you say, ironically, there is no religious tolerance in Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi government enforces this intolerance. If a Muslim converts to Christianity, it's the death penalty. But this UN conference was called by Saudi Arabia, and it's seen by many. This conference is seen by many as a subterfuge to get the non-Muslims to agree to give preference to Islam, to get international acceptance of Muslim supremacy. Please comment.
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually. The question is, how can the Saudis promote religious tolerance outside of their country when there is absolutely no religious tolerance inside Saudi Arabia itself? The Human Rights Watch came up recently, October, with a scathing report of religious oppression of Saudi minorities, and I would recommend that for people to read. That's an ironic. The Saudis are extremely clever, and the problem with the West is they have always miscalculated the Saudis' ability to manipulate the West in general and use its rule of law to promote their own interest. You have to understand the interpretation of this. First of all, the Saudis have a lot of hidden agendas, well, maybe not too hidden. They want to establish, the royal family want to establish itself as the spokesperson for Islam, or at least for Sunni Islam. Therefore, the king went to the Pope in July, and then they had this Madrid conference a couple months ago, and then they had the United Nations. You have to understand the understanding or what the king of Saudi Arabia is promoting is for the West and non-Muslims to accept Islam as it is. Now, the West and non-Muslim understanding of religious tolerance is to respect other religions and live and let live. The Saudis see it as accept Islam as it is. And this is where the problem is. The West have always been manipulated by the Saudi regimes. The Saudi regime is using the Western democracy to promote its interest. Now, if the Saudi regimes or any Muslim regime actually serious about this religious tolerance and religious dialogue, interfaith dialogue, they would have these meetings, or at least one of them, held inside a Muslim country. It's not. It's done in Spain, in Rome, and New York, because they are not interested in religious tolerance as we understand it, and they are not interested in having their people respect other people and their religious beliefs, democratic values, lifestyle, or whatever values they have. So this is the irony here. There is no religious tolerance. Saudi Arabia is probably the least tolerant of any religion in the world. These are facts. These are documented facts. This is not something I am saying that do not exist. They do exist. I mean, all you have to do is to go to the State Department annual reports about religious freedom or the United States International Commission on Religious Freedom, the Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, any organization. These are documented facts. So this interfaith dialogue and culture of peace, it is pretty misunderstood in the West, but the Saudis know exactly what they are promoting. And I think this is a huge dangerous. There is a movement in this country to promote the Sharia law, Islamic banking. I'm not against anybody or any religion. I am against imposition of laws that will only destroy democratic values. There is something, the Sharia law, if Sharia law is great, then why are there no liberties for women, religious minorities, judicial system? And if the Islamic banking system is right and good, why all Muslim countries' economies are among the worst in the world? I mean, you get to ask questions, and this is what we are trying to make people understand. Understand what is being pushed before you upload it or embrace it. Again, our center, we are promoting understanding based on individual liberty, human rights, women's rights, and less government. I'm not talking about less government, as some people say here. But people have to live by choice. They have to worship by choice. In Saudi Arabia, there is no religious freedom for anybody, including Muslims themselves, including the Wahhabis themselves. If you didn't pray and you didn't fast, you got flogged, your shop got closed, and you could actually go to prison. This is a fact of life.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. Again, I have other calls, but I would like to reintroduce the guest that we have with us this morning, Dr. Ali Al-Yami. He is the founder and executive director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, a group that is based in the United States in Washington, D.C. They do have a website. If you're interested in finding out what they're all about, you can go there. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here. Next up, Champaign County and Line 2. Hello.
Hi. I thought I was in line here. I wanted to talk about, or have you talk about, category of human rights abuse that I've heard about Saudi Arabia being linked with historically, and that's the guest worker treatment. There are a lot of third-party nationals, Arab and otherwise, in Saudi Arabia who are just in almost virtual servitude, it seems. I don't know if anything has changed on that, whether there's been any. The U.S. is not very good about signing International Labor Organization agreements, so it's kind of a little we should be cleaning up our own record as far as labor agreements, it seems. But given that, what can you say about that category? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Yeah, that's another good question, actually. And this is one of the most unspoken or untalked about tragedy in Saudi Arabia. There are about, first of all, I would never compare anything that happens in the United States with what happened in Saudi Arabia. I think that's an insult to this country and its democratic values. We have problems in this country, and we all know it, but we could fix them, and we have the right to fix them. We could elect anybody we want, and we just elected an African-American president of the United States, which is impossible to even think about this in any Arab country or Muslim country. But the tragedy of the about 9 million expatriates, and many of them are Christians, actually, from the Philippines, Indonesia, and Sri Lanka, and India, and Pakistan, and other places. These are cheap laborers who are almost literally become slaves the minute they arrived in Saudi Arabia. The minute they arrived in Saudi Arabia, and they are sponsored by different businesses, their sponsors confiscate their passports the minute they come to Saudi Arabia, which means you cannot leave the country, you cannot leave the employer. Let's say if you have, and they got meager salaries, $100 here per month, $200, $300 max. They do all the work that keep the Saudi economy afloat, actually, and the country afloat. They have no rights. They have no benefits. Their children couldn't go to school after high schools, like colleges and stuff. They cannot, and many of these people, at least, there are no scientific statistics allowed in Saudi Arabia. So you get to figure out by estimation or government figures or Saudi media figures or anything. But there are about 2 to 3 million, if I'm not mistaken. I could be mistaken here in terms of the number, but about maybe 2 million of these expatriates are mates, woman mates, who live in people's homes 24 hours a day. So, they work 24 hours a day if they are needed because they live in the house. Now, these people these women are used for more than maids to clean the house and cook and take care of children. They are used for sexual, services. They are used for anything that people want. They get beaten, they get abused, and there have been, I think we have some pictures on our website of somebody who were burned and all over their bodies and stuff. So these people are treated in a whole lot worse than servitude, as the gentleman mentioned in his question. And the United States government and Western government and the governments, all of the governments where these people come from the countries they come from, they don't support them. And the reason for that, many of the governments where these people come from depend upon Saudi's financial help, loans, and oil export, which some of them get for free, as far as we know, or we didn't know, because there is no transparency. Or, you know, the only people who know what really happens in the country is a few princes at the top. So the treatment of the expatriates in Saudi Arabia is abominable, and the international community have failed miserably to raise this issue at international level. Human rights, the Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and our group and others, we raise these issues, but it hasn't been brought up to international forums like the United Nations or any forum of that caliber. And it is unacceptable. It is unacceptable. It is inhumane. It is against every grain of any civilized society or people. So I cannot say enough about this. I cannot say enough about what's happening to the expatriates in Saudi Arabia. We as human beings, as a nation, as democracy, have responsibility. And I'm hoping that the new government, Mr. Obama administration, will change that and stand for what this country stands for and make it the envy of the world. He is absolutely right when he said it is our democratic values and liberty that make us stronger as opposed to our military and economic wealth. And I hope he sticks with that, and we will try our best to remind him of that.
At the beginning of the conversation, I asked a general question about how it is you think perhaps U.S. policy in the Arab world has gone wrong. And you said that perhaps one of the big things was that the United States has been supporting governments in the Arab world that were not democratic governments, that were not freely elected, and that is one reason that many people in the Arab world resent the government of the United States for that very reason. Let me ask you this, because I am sure that the governments that we're talking about, the Saudi government and other governments, say to the United States that the opposition to them within their countries are militant Islamist parties, and that I'm sure that they would say to the United States, you don't want these people coming to power because they are not, they don't share your interests, they don't share your worldview, they're very anti-American, and for that reason, I'm sure that these governments continue to argue to the United States that it's better that they stay in power than somebody else come to power.
That's an excellent question. You choose the lesser of the evil, as the cliche goes. But the evil we are supporting is the evil who creates the evils that they are warning us against. All of these extremists are conceived, hatched, incubated on the institutions of the very same governments that they are telling us we are better off than these people. You know, common sense has to prevail. Why would Arab governments be interested, for example, in getting rid of somebody like bin Laden and al-Qaeda and these extremists? Because if they get rid of them, then they will lose their argument. It's either us or these extremists. It's in the best interest of these regimes in Egypt and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and the rest. It's in these government best interests that bin Laden actually didn't get killed, that al-Qaeda remain, that the Wahhabi extremists in Saudi Arabia gain strength. That's how they survive, because they come to the West, you are absolutely right, they come to the West and the United States, and everybody else said, look at the alternative. But we should be saying, you created these alternatives. They are in your payroll. Your institution teach them. And so you are responsible. So, for example, there is absolutely no difference between the Saudi government and bin Laden's group, al-Qaeda groups, no difference in their attitude and policies toward Iraq. They didn't want democracy in Iraq. They didn't want women's rights in Iraq. They didn't want democratic constitutions and Iraq and Bill of Rights. They didn't want the majority to rule in Iraq because the majority are Shiites. So there is no difference between the Saudi government policy towards Iraq and bin Laden policy or activities in Iraq. This is where the West have failed, and I'm not sure it is stupidity or ignorance. I think the West, as I said, because the Western United States and Western Europe policies toward people like the Saudis is based on a group individual interest. So these governments' interests are tied with the existing regimes, because if you have democracies in the Middle East and you have empowerment of women, and you will have to deal with you will have to deal with elected bodies like parliaments and Congress, as opposed to deal with a king who will just sit with you over, you know, a cup of bitter tea or coffee or whatever. And he will shake hands with you and the deal is done. So we have to take some responsibility for what we are actually doing to ourselves by supporting these regimes. Again, the regimes in the Middle East and the Arab world and some of the Muslim countries, especially in Saudi Arabia, their interest is to keep these extremists alive, healthy, and well. Because if they go, They have no argument to convince us we should support them.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And again, our guest is Dr. Ali Al-Yami. He is the founder and the executive director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. This is a group that is based in the United States, in Washington, D.C., and that was founded to promote democratic changes in Saudi Arabia. They're also particularly interested in not just in political reform, but also in religious freedom and in women's rights. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have someone else to talk with here in Morris on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you. I believe all the problems exist out there in the Middle East solely because of oil. If people stop buying oil from them and supporting the regimes, basically the Saudi sheiks, that maybe, just maybe, things will turn better. I do believe that trying to change attitudes in the Middle East is basically not there. I don't think we have a chance in doing it. If we just isolate them and quit being involved with them and worry about us and protecting our own, maybe they'll see us in a different light. Am I not correct?
Look, the Middle Eastern people, I think your question about changing attitudes is very important. And, yes, there has to be a transformation of perceptions, because the Middle Eastern people, especially the Arab people, especially in close societies like Saudi Arabia, they have been bombarded with negative depiction of democracy and the West and liberties. And, I mean, all of these things have been depicted as anti-Islamic beliefs and anti-Islam and Muslims. Oil plays a major role in the Middle Eastern countries and the rest of the world, sure. But that's not, I mean, we play major roles by our technology and planes and materials. The Chinese plays a huge role in, with their products, and the Japanese and the Koreans and others. That's not the point. The point is you are dealing with regimes that have only one item in their agenda, and that is to stay in power, regardless who pays and how people pay. The oil is a commodity. The people of the Middle East, or the governments and the regimes in the Middle East, have to sell it to survive, and we consume it. It's just like computer is a commodity. People buy it from us, but it's a, you know, we don't have any other agenda other than exporting and selling our products. The problem is oil only as long as we let it be a problem. And that is, I mean, oil is going to go. Oil is going to be consumed, and frankly speaking, sooner before people think. Mm-hmm. And we have to have replacement for oil. Otherwise, it's our civilization as we know it is finished. But oil is only a tool, and it depends upon how is it used, and how do we, in this country and the rest of the world, how do we manage to keep it as a commodity?
There are people in Saudi Arabia who would like to see the government change. There are people who believe that that change could come and should come peacefully, but there are also people who would be willing to do that by violence.
Well, the violence is going on. Saudi Arabia has never been unstable than it is right now. And it's, I mean, there are 5,000, almost 5,000 violent people who are either being tried in Saudi courts or rehabilitation camps, or, you know, whether they are religious people or religious people, we don't really know. The Saudi government tell us they are all religious extremists, but since Islam is the only tool people could use to get rid of their opponents, they might be other than religious people. Saudis, many millions of Saudis are very educated people, especially among women. They want a change. They want something better. They want to be respected. They want human rights. They want to be empowered as individual, for example. They want to be free to worship as they wish or they don't worship. I mean, they may not tell you that, because if they tell you that, their heads start rolling. That's the system. But there are millions of Saudis who would like to see change. I happen to believe, and we are promoting a non-violent process to change the system. We are promoting empowerment of women, religious freedom, privatization of all government industries, free press, empowerment of the existing councils to become elected assemblies. This takes time, but it has. These things have to be established, and it has to start in a transparent way. We promote independent treasury, for example, where the money comes, it goes to the king and his family's treasury. We promote accountability, transparency. We promote all the things that will bring a tolerant, forward-looking, self-reliance society in Saudi Arabia. We are not calling for military revolution. We are not calling for invading the country. We are not calling for dividing the country. That is counterproductive, and it doesn't go anywhere except bring more totalitarianism. So there are, yes, of course, to answer to your question, yes, there are millions of educated Saudis who would like to see change. The problem is they have no way to express themselves except the Internet, which has become the most used medium, and especially in places like Saudi Arabia. So, yes, an answer to your question, there are Saudis who would like to see change. They may not want to see overthrow of the government overnight, but they want to see a gradual sharing of power where people determine their own destiny instead of few people at the top dictate to them the life they have to live and the clothes they have to wear and the time they have to pray. That is not acceptable to most Saudis anymore.
Back to another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. From someone on the outside looking in, it seems that before Islam and the West can reconcile, that the schism within Islam itself, the Shia and the Sunnis, has to have some modification, I think, or some way of the people understanding the whole concept of reconciliation. And I don't know the situation in Saudi Arabia in terms of Shia and Sunni, but what is that condition of the hostility between Shia and Sunni, and what impact does that have on the rest of us wanting to reconcile?
You know, religious freedom is the key. You allow people to practice their beliefs as they wish, like we do in this country. We have hundreds of different religions and languages and all, you name it, in this country. And here we are. We live side by side. We don't interfere in each other's religion, way of life. You could do anything you want as long as you didn't harm the society. There is nothing equal to religious freedom. Let people worship as they wish. Religion is very personal. It's between a person and his or her creator. It's a conscious decision. So religious freedom is the key. In terms of the schisms within Islam itself, it's a long history, but also it is used by these regimes to support themselves, like Shias versus Sunnis, Iran versus Saudi Arabia, for example, was extremist Sunni religion and the other, sect of Islam, and the other one is extremist Shiite group. But the people themselves, the Iranian people and the Saudi people, could live easily if it is not for the regime using religion to divide them and to turn people against each other. So religious freedom is the key, and this is one thing that the United States and other democratic societies have to advocate, promote publicly, and make our foreign policy. The United States, actually, recently Congress has passed a bill where it makes religious freedom is part of the United States foreign policy, which is a very good step. This is just like 2-3 months ago. So we should have that condition. Our dealings with the Saudis or anybody, religious freedom has to be part of that. So religious freedom is the key, and I cannot say this enough in the Middle East or anywhere else, actually, but religious freedom is the key in terms of reconciling differences, whether it is among Muslims themselves or between Muslims and non-Muslims. Religious freedom, there is nothing equal to that, and there is nothing that will substitute for it.
I want to thank the last caller. We just have about a minute left. To go back to the discussion we were having before, when I raised the point about the possibility there would be people who would favor violent overthrow of the Saudi royal family, I certainly was not mentioning that to suggest that would be good. But I guess my question was whether that would be, how possible that might be, and whether, in fact, if that happened, it would actually make things worse.
Well, it depends. I mean, as I said, there is no substitute. This is a fact of life also. At this point, there is no substitute for the royal family in Saudi Arabia. And I didn't say you said, you know, violence is a good thing. I may have misspoken, but presently there is no substitute simply because the Saudi royal family have prevented any creation of civil society, political party, freedom of expression, a freedom of press. Anybody who oppose the system or criticize the system, let's oppose it, either go to jail or something else. So the in order for substitute to come, you have to allow for civil society, and this is what we are promoting. Allow for civil society, political parties, and actually, interestingly enough, there are some princes like Prince Talal, who has been calling for a constitutional monarchy for the last 60 years. He's the father of the rich Prince Al-Walid, who gives millions of dollars to American universities here. So there is no substitute at this point, but you see, the problem is, as long as the situation remains as it is right now, violent revolution is going to come from the religious extremists or from people who have lost hope that the present regime is willing to share power voluntarily. Either the religious extremists will take over, or in collaboration with those who would like to see power sharing but couldn't do it by themselves, so they will collaborate with the religious extremists to overthrow the regime. This is also knowledge. This is a knowledge that is you will find this among many high American officials and European officials that a violent revolution in Saudi Arabia might not be avoidable.
We will have to stop there. For people who are interested in reading more, you can go to the website of the organization we've been talking about here, the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. It's based in Washington, D.C. And our guest this morning is the founder and the director, Dr. Ali Al-Yami. Dr. Al-Yami, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, sir, and I really appreciate this, and I hope you will continue same program like this, because they play a major role in terms of putting pressure on regimes like the Saudis.
Yes. Well, thank you again.
Thank you, sir.
Support for the broadcast today comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, for over 15 years providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Suggestions, requests, always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. We'll break for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.